This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
On the UAE's number one talk radio station, Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer and this is the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. We were talking money, careers and the law on today's show with some amazing experts sharing their stories and indeed their advice. We were finding out about how female-led businesses have helped spur a bit of a retail spike in the region with Nancy Osbeck of Times Square Centre. How do you begin to curate who and what will call a mall home, and how are they helping businesses go from table at a market to a tenant in their space? Shraddha Bharat Amare was talking about the ever-changing landscape of PR and marketing and taking your questions as well. Kimono Girl is a clothing brand that believes in energy fashion. Intrigued you should be. The founder was in the studio to explain more. And we were talking to Taqwa Malik, the founder of Freedom Advisory. Top tips on selling your brand on an e-commerce platform, how to stand out from your competitors. And as ever, Ludmila Malava of HPL Malava and Pluko was on hand taking your legal questions and addressing something that caught my eye in the headlines. Could you get fined for having a noisy dog?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking retail this hour, and female-led businesses have really helped spur something of a retail revival in the region. One mall that's been supporting that is Times Square. And with us now is Nancy Osbeck, the general manager. Nancy, thank you so much for being with us today. I think you've got such an interesting job because we all know that each mall has a kind of identity, a feel, sometimes a smell, a specialty. So when it comes to you kind of zooming out on what you want to achieve, how on earth does a mall plan on like who and what we'll call at home?
Helen, we would like to say Times Square Center is a family. We are one big family over there. The group itself, it's very much local family, Sharaf Group. And we as Times Square Center, starting from mall management up until our tenant and whole environment, one big family. And the family feels secure and family enjoy, family learn, family stay active. This is us. This is Times Square Center, tenant and as well as developer.
Because you've got a real quite eclectic mix in there. And I was in just over Eid break, actually. I took some clothes into Thrift for Good upstairs, the charity shop, which I ended up spending as much as I brought in, which, you know, it's all about that. You're wearing a necklace now from there.
Perfect.
So I think that's quite interesting. It's an interesting store in itself when I think about singling out some of the stores there. So how do you then decide, you know, how to prioritize and curate who's going to call at home?
First of all, 4 years ago, we sit and we said that what family needs? Family needs security. Family needs education and health. And we said, let's differentiate ourselves because there are lots of malls in the world, even not in Dubai. And then we said, okay, we have to find out a unique sales point and which people will find Times Square Center different than the others. And then we set our core values, or we like to say today our pillars. Our pillar is about sustainability. Our pillar is about education. Even we combine two words, education and entertainment, what we call education, and health and lifestyle and community. And we said, okay, from now on, a concept, who thinks like us will be welcoming to the mall. Mm-hmm. So either one or two point, they have to think with the same idea. That's why we started to accept our tenant. Like you mentioned, Thrift for Goods. We are so happy. It's our community part. What we do, we need to give our community back. And we support small businesses, SMEs, women, whoever has an initiative, an innovative idea, and as well as fitting with sustainability. And then we start to select our tenant and we fill the blanks. And today, we are there, happily.
It is a real diverse portfolio, but I think that's really interesting to come back to those pillars, those values. Does that mean that you would turn some people or brands away if they didn't necessarily fit?
Yes, we did. We started, okay, we are selecting the concept. If it is not fitting our pillar out, we are not looking into that. And then we request them either they have to follow our strategy, differentiate themselves, or please give us our location back. So if you look at Helen, any concept, like Three Four Goods, every concept has their different point. We collected 8 different classes under one room. Melodica, music classes, education part. Our own concept, Adventure HQ, hiking, biking, jumping, stay active. And we have Naya Pilates Yoga Studio, but this is not another yoga studio. What is the difference is you can go over there when you are pregnant. You can go and do your yoga and Pilates when you have your baby, when you have your kids. Welcome. Stretch studio. While you are doing your exercise, you can't reach all 360 muscle, but stretch studio, one-on-one therapist is reaching that. Orange Theory. It's not another fitness studio. They are really pushing your zone. That's why they call red. And we have, for example, tennis area. Because it's so difficult when you play tennis and you cannot find everything under one roof. But it is their Times Square Center. I love to describe Times Square Center is not a place you can come and buy pen, but you will make your pen. Or you will not come Times Square Center to buy a painting. But you will make a painting by yourself. You can be horrible with art, but you will come out with the art pieces you can give to your friends, your husband, loved one, whoever you want. This is very much us.
I wanted to ask about how you strike that balance, because some of the companies that you have been supporting and, you know, talking female-led businesses in particular this afternoon, might be having a retail space for the very first time. And we know that, you know, rents can be very tricky to, well, make sure you're covering all your bases when it comes to marketing, your rent, your product, you know, everything. Not to ask a too indelicate question, but are you able to assist when it comes to rents for smaller businesses that might be striking out for the first time?
To support smaller businesses is my passion and my group passion and Times Square Center passion. Yes, please welcome. We will always have a space for them. How? I really recommend, especially if the subjects are women, and we need to be more careful. But I know many women, and by using their personal expenses and put into Times Square Center small market, and I can give a name, Arte, Baby Bazaar, and Ripe Market, they can have a very small table over there. They don't have to spend a lot. And then let them differentiate themselves on that small table. And then our eye will be always on them. We will carry them to smaller kiosk, what we define in shopping center management. And then once we see the success, because we are keeping recording their sales record, and then we see the success, and then they are always welcome to the big unit. I really proudly say, more than 10 different tenants at Times Square Center started their journey with their personal saving in a small table. And now we have even mini anchor tenant at Times Square Center, Exxon Soldier. We have Blossom Honey, Spark Bake, and Studio Lab, where you can make your pen. But these are the one who started in a small table. That's why I really recommend women, come to us, your initiatives, come to us, your different ideas. We will find a table for you. You don't have to spend anything. If we see the success, then we are ready to spend full speed.
Well, Nancy, we were talking there about how some of your tenants literally started off with a table at some of the many markets that you've hosted in the past, whether that is, you know, Ripe or Baby Bazaar, Arte as well, of course. But if someone wants to make that leap, how do you advise them? Because I think that's a very intimidating thought of going, okay, well, you know, I've got my business license and I make this, or I've got my business license and I sell that, to then going, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to pay rent and employ someone and take things perhaps a bit more seriously than I'd first intended. Because sometimes it's fear of failure, but sometimes it's fear of success that can stop people taking that next step.
That's why I always recommend them. And don't go immediately your trade license. Arte, Baby Bazaar, and Ripe have your trade license on behalf of you. Taste your product. If it works, definitely you will have a table from us by yourself. Or we will provide you a concept. Even soon, very soon, together with our PR company Tish Dash, we will introduce 2 shelves. We recently executed one project we call Picnic Square. And we would love to say it's meat, eat and greet place, and we are going to provide 2 different chefs to 2 different innovative idea. We will be supporting women in that chef. You can bring your idea to us, and we are not going to charge you rental. We would like to see your success 6 months, with zero rental, nothing. After 6 months, we will look into your sales and we will guide you how you can be more successful. That is the time we will introduce turnover rental. So another 1 year, depend on our decision and your product and how it is going on, we will charge only turnover rent. So which means if you do better, we will do better. And after that, hopefully, like other tenant, you can come one day to me, tell me that, Nancy, I don't want to pay turnover rent. Can we fix the rent? Because I'm paying too much. I hope we can do this conversation with you there.
If anyone wants to find out more, by all means, do WhatsApp us on 4001 or 0487 15500, and we could connect you with the team at Times Square if this is something that you're looking to explore. And you mentioned there, you know, meet and eat and greet. It feels like, and I'm not just saying this because I was in a few malls over the Eid break, shopping is back. We're talking about e-commerce later in the show and offering some advice for people wanting their products to stand out when it comes to selling online. But how do you feel like, you know, retail and bricks and mortar commerce is doing in light of a pretty significant crisis as a result of the pandemic?
Yes, but I'm happily saying it's not a subject for Times Square Center, because Helen, could you buy and experience your kids? Try to buy experience online for your kids, a climbing wall. So where are you going to climb? You have to come to Times Square Center. If you want your kids to do a pen, if you want your kids to do robots, or if you want your kids to do painting, you have to come and you have to visit Times Square Center. You have to touch the material and create it, something else.
So I think that's an interesting point, in the sense that, and we think about this with online, you know, ordering food online compared to that restaurant experience, you can't necessarily compare like for like. But so you feel that it's not necessarily about going in and having that transaction, it's about a social space as well.
Exactly. But on the other side, I have to be honest over here. Of course, food and beverage is affected much more than the others, because we recently launched our Eat Meets Grid space, and it was normally very easy to lease the location. We had some difficulty because there are lots of cloud kitchen outside, mm-hmm. and people started to order online. But we will get over it again by differentiating ourselves. What we have done, we have created during this challenging time, we changed the challenge to opportunity. We have a concept, Baby Eat Restaurant. That is the location. Babies are coming, making friendship each other every Tuesday together with Exxon Soldiers and Baby Eat Restaurant. And they come and they meet over there with their small babies. They cook over there organic food and healthy food. It's amazing what we are doing. So always there is challenge, but why not? We can change the opportunity.
Can I ask you to get the crystal ball out and have a look to the future of retail, Nancy Osbeck? What do you see happening when it comes to spending trends, you know, opportunities perhaps? Where do you see it going?
Yes, of course, online is taking a bit from malls. We have to focus again how to differentiate ourselves and how we can select our tenant. Mm-hmm. I think this is the key subject. Otherwise, yes, we will share our income with online businesses. But on the other side, what we have seen during this time, I really would like to mention, I have found 3 different online businesses. 2 of them are successful businesswoman. She was doing great online, but the point came, she said that she needs a location.
I know who you're talking about.
Where she has to display her product because they want to touch and feel the concept. Welcome again.
Is it Citroën?
Yes.
So I'm a massive fan of this brand. Yes. I have their packed lunch boxes. My kids do too. And I think that is actually, we're going to be talking about e-commerce, as I said, later on in the show, and helping people kind of navigate that space if they are retailers. But there are some products that do lend themselves to, you know, just being purely online. But there are some products where I feel like you need to have that tangible experience.
Exactly.
So I was thrilled for her when that happened. I really, really was, because she has gone from selling through various websites and Instagram to now having a space. And how surreal must that be to think, okay, people can come and interact with these products, and now I've got, you know, the name above a door?
Yeah, actually, it makes us very happy because I have in the pipeline another three brands soon we will introduce, exactly like Citron. And they need a physical space. So that's why when I look at this online, yes, there will be some businesses online and they will not be looking for like 20,000, 30,000 anchor unit. However, they will always need some physical store, or maybe in the future there will be some area. This is another idea we would like to have some, you know, service center, because we buy online, but it's always headache for us if we didn't like, or if the size does not fit, or if it needs maintenance. So click collect store. Mm-hmm. There is always another way. And I love to say Nemo from the childhood of my kids. I love that one. There is always another way.
Gotta we'll keep swimming. That. Gotta yes. keep swimming. Well, Nancy, yes. It sounds like there's a lot of innovation going on there, as well as a lot of heart. And you have become a real champion for a lot of female-led businesses here, and some great success stories coming out. So thank you for your time and all of the efforts. But if anyone does want to find out more about some of the initiatives in building your business and perhaps even taking over retail space, by all means do reach out on 4001. We'll be very happy to connect you with the team at Times Square Centre. Nancy, thank you so much. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much having us, Times Square Centre.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Joining us live online is the founder of White Label. It's a PR and marketing company based here in the UAE that has truly gone the distance and is here to help if you need any PR and marketing insights. Shraddha Bharath Amarel joining us to answer my questions and yours. How are you, Shraddha? Lovely to have you with us.
Hi, Helen. I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Now, we think about PR and marketing, you know, kind of all very, you know, glam and, you know, nonstop. It is definitely nonstop. What attracted you to this industry initially, and how has it changed since you got your start?
Oh, gosh. So when I started nearly 10 years ago, actually, it is this April that we completed 10 years of White Label. And I actually started in my living room. It was my fourth business at that time. And it happened to me by fluke, because at that time I had hired an agency for one of my businesses to announce the launch of our company, all of that. And I just felt that there was a slight disconnect in terms of maybe the agency wasn't used to working with business owners directly. And I just felt that I needed a more consulting approach to PR. And I was like, okay, let me try this on my own, and absolutely got addicted. I really, really enjoy it. I really love the world of PR. So for someone who has absolutely zero background in PR, it literally had no idea what I was doing when I started. But yeah, fast forward 10 years, it's very, very grateful for where we've reached.
And what kind of companies do you like to work with? You know, who resonates with you?
So it happened to be that we love F&B, and F&B loves us back. So we initially started with a couple of restaurant clients, and over the years we've looked after 75 different restaurant launches, including one now in Riyadh as well. So F&B is something, as let's say, our strongest forte, followed by fashion, anything that is lifestyle, wellness, beauty. So that's more so of our expertise.
A question here from Sue saying, when do you instruct a PR company? Good question, because we've just been talking about moving into a retail space, for example. We're going to be talking about e-commerce, you know, going from a table at a market to a tenant in a space. But it could be any kind of business. How and when do you find people are coming to you? At what stage in their business journey?
So we have a lot of, let's say, particularly if you're looking at F&B, you have, you know, we have a lot of hospitality consultants who build concepts and things like that, wherein we'll come in 1 month before the launch. I do always try and, you know, educate and create awareness for my clients that PR is unfortunately not a very much, you know, urgent, it can be done in a day kind of a game. It does take time to build up. A lot of our colleagues in the industry, they work as per their deadlines. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you send a press release today and, you know, you'll be out in the magazines and on the radio tomorrow. So we need to respect, you know, there are timelines and deadlines and schedules that all the media houses have. So usually I would say keep a 1 month, you know, timeline versus when you want to go into the market and create buzz. At the same time, seasonality really matters. So let's say, for example, we had a couple of clients who launched just before the Eid holidays, but we've advised them that we will look into making the announcements and things like that once all our friends from the industry are back on their desk today. And then slowly but surely, they will start seeing some bugs coming out. So also timing is very important, not to do it during the time that it's going to be closed mm-hmm. and everyone's going to be traveling. People are not really focused. They're busy with their family. And just to make sure to keep like at least the 4 weeks of timeline when you want to actually see a bug happening.
Hope that helps. Shredder's with us this afternoon from White Label. Happy to help out on some PR and marketing questions. We were going to talk your money diaries, but we have got quite a few queries coming in on the text line for you, Shredder. So we're going to help out the listening public this afternoon. 4001. Sure. Question from Sharina here saying, please may I ask about rebranding? We want to change the name and logo of our company, but don't want to lose or confuse our customers. Any insights? Great question. I don't know what kind of business this is. Sharina hasn't said. But is there any kind of broader advice, I guess, you could offer regarding a rebrand?
I would say often you would see that in my case, let's say I took a very non-PR approach to White Label. So for many, many years, people have known White Label. They didn't really know who was the person behind White Label. And that was a very conscious decision from my end, because at that time, it was my fourth business and there are three other kind of failed businesses that led me to White Label. So I was like, I'm not yet sure to tell people who's behind it. Let me like make sure this is running. And then, you know, I'll be comfortable to announce if, you know, this is my company and this is where I see it going, etc. So it also depends that if your customers already know you, and it's a very popular example that Procter & Gamble also, they live by, they say that people buy people. So if your customers know you, they trust you, there is faith in you, then even if you were to rebrand, I would say that, you know, don't really worry as much about it. You can still go in and announce, and people for sure would welcome you with open arms, even with the new logo, new name, as long as they've worked with you in the past, they know your work, and they can stand by the quality of work or service or maybe the product that you deliver.
And Walter here asking on WhatsApp, are purchased media lists still essential for PR? Interesting. As someone who's been on media lists for 15 years in Dubai, I get an awful lot of emails that I perhaps shouldn't really be on the list for. I don't know, again, where Walter's kind of speaking from as such, but what would you say?
I would say PR is all about relations. If that was the case, you know, people would buy lists and not really hire agencies or consultants, etc. So it's all about when you hire an agency, you're actually hiring them for the relationships that they've worked very hard to cultivate. They've done the one-to-one pitches with their media. For sure you have. We also have a lot of young people that join our team and we train them and nurture them. But it's also not just the contacts, right? It's about how to pitch them, when to pitch them, what kind of stories to write. We know what our friends in the industry like, they don't like, what they might bite on. So there's a whole strategy and a lot of expertise that goes into before even we send out that press release to the press.
Shredder, we've run out of time. I have run out of questions. I'd love to talk to you a bit more about the money matters, the saving, the splurging, but some really interesting questions. So thank you again for your time. If anyone is looking to hire your services, pick your brains, what's the best way of getting in touch?
My email is shredder@whitelabelmedia.me, or you can always follow us on Instagram, whitelabelme, and reach us through social media.
Thank you so much. Really do appreciate your time as ever. Get back to your the demands of the clients and we'll talk to you very, very soon.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Pleasure.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Have you ever put on an outfit and thought, today I feel powerful, beautiful, at peace and confident? Well, one woman that wanted to show other women how to awaken their inner goddess and have a bit of a positive transformation through the power of clothes, joining us in the studio now. Margaery Otis is the founder of Kimono Girl, which she also calls Energy Fashion. Energy Fashion? What? I don't know where to start with this, but I love the sound of it. How can you describe it to us?
Yes, so it's so nice to be here, Helen.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much. Yes, so our company is called Kimono Girl, and we are an energy fashion brand to empower women by giving them a superpower.
Tell me more. We all
and, you know,
need it.
I always think like women are so incredible. We are already born with superpowers, but we tend to forget that. So we are literally here to remind them how great they are.
through clothing. Now, I've had these moments where you put on something. I mean, I very rarely wear high heels, but sometimes I put on heels or I put on an outfit that I feel the colours work or it matches the mood I'm in. It can be transformative. And you might not necessarily look that different to everyone else around you, but you feel different and you project that power and confidence. And sometimes it's a sense of peace. But what you do, it's not just about how the clothes look. It's in some way the way you put them together and the energy you do that with. Tell us more.
Yes. So, Helen, do you believe in energy?
Of course I do.
Excellent. As do we. Absolutely. So, in fact, scientifically, it's proven that energy is all around us. And it is so important to keep it positive. Like, your life quality depends on the energy around you, right? So we go through, like, I mean, there is different ways to do keep your energy high, such as yoga, meditation, go have a walk in a park with your dog, and clothing is no exception. And we go through several steps to actually make it magical. For example, we embroider mantras inside of the kimono, which has a deep meaning, different meanings and vibrations. Every kimono has a different mantra. Then we also have a sacred ceremony with our energy master to charge the kimonos with high frequencies and pure energy. And finally, the kimono actually comes with letter from the universe, which then holds information how to activate your own kimono with your energies and follow the affirmation. And we actually see now incredibly it's been working, because if you follow the affirmation 3 to 6 weeks, your life will be transformed.
I want to know some of the affirmations. Can you tell us?
Well, one of the good ones is that in the morning when you wake up, when your feet touch the floor, you genuinely are grateful to be alive. And you say, thank you that I'm healthy, I'm alive. And another trick also is that you look at yourself in the mirror and you say, thank you for wonderful surprises I'm receiving today. And there is always something's coming without you even knowing what's going to happen.
This absolutely is the truth. Now, you're from Estonia. You spent a decade in London working in the corporate world in fintech. And this probably couldn't be more of a departure from your life even just a couple of years ago. Can you tell us about that journey and what brought you here and into a completely different industry?
Yes, it's been a journey. Well, I am from Estonia. It's a very tiny country. We only have 1 million people. So I'm literally one in a million. but we are a very spiritual country. We are grown up with, you know, healings from the forest and trusting our gut feeling. But yes, I've been also in London. I'm actually coming from London. I've been there a decade, climbing that corporate ladder in a very much male-dominant industry. I was in finance and technology. And, you know, whilst I was feeling empowered with my pencil skirt and high heels, giving important presentation for a room full of bankers, it was only when I quit my job and, you know, started traveling around and I was wearing a kimono, you know, and I had this long, flowy kimono that made me feel like a goddess, right? And this goddess feeling, I'm like, this is empowerment. I want to give this for everyone else. And that's the journey. In corporate in general, I've seen so much inequality between men and women. And I've always wanted to empower women. I didn't know how, but because of this kimono I was wearing, all my holidays, gardening leave, that's where the idea came from. And now I'm in Dubai, which is also incredible to be here.
I don't know that much about Estonia, but it's not known for kimonos, to my knowledge. What is it about this garment that you think is you know, really worth a bit of a special look at?
Yes, that's exactly the reason that because I wore it and I felt the sensation of being a goddess, that is the reason I chose the kimono as a tool and platform for women to increase their vibration, plus adding all this special extras on top of it, of course. I like to say, healing through clothing, and it's going to be your cape and armor.
I love the sound of this, finding your superpower. What were some of the big challenges that you have faced in making that transition?
Oh, so many. First, it was a massive leap of faith to even quit my job. I had a great role, you know, safe salary. But, you know, making the decision, you only can, you know, go to the next step. And having the idea of creating energy fashion was simply because we are here to make the world a better place. Whilst we all want to do it, you know, we have to start with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And whilst we're doing it ourselves, we don't have to change the world anymore.
So did you not feel like you were making the world a better place in your previous job?
No. Maybe with my good attitude on meetings, a little bit here and there. But I definitely now with energy fashion, I see that we can reach bigger numbers and really make the difference.
Now, with the pieces, they are really, when I say special, I mean they're obviously a huge amount of care taken from the design to where they're made. Tell us a little bit about the manufacturing process and the journey that a garment will go through from your head to the person who wears it.
Yes, there is a lot of love and effort put into them, and it has taken quite a bit. We are manufacturing in India. It has the spiritual meaning to it. It's made by a family-run business, all handmade. And you know, our collection is four elements. And elements are known as, you know, energy forces by ancient times to nowadays. And every kimono is a different element. So it depends what you need in your life that moment of time. You should choose that element so you would get the properties as your superpower. For example.
What are you wearing now?
Yes, exactly. I'm wearing water. And water is makes me unbreakable because you can't break water. And it's going with the flow and rebirth. Earth, right?
Tell us about the other ones and some of the qualities that you are hoping to be kind of transmitted through those pieces.
Yes. So we have fire, which is like if you need a like inner strength and transformation, you should get that. Or grounding, if you need grounding and nurturing in your life, you kind of get earth. Or then air is going with the flow and intelligence. They're very different. And actually, it's literally whatever pulls you the most, you should wear that.
So do you presumably have your kimonos at home and you might feel attracted to one over another in the morning?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Like, because they're mine as well. It's, you know, they give me so much energy and power. When I'm like, as an entrepreneur, sometimes I feel down. I literally need to go there and see them and touch them, and they are magic. Absolutely agree with that.
Now, you've been on a bit of a spiritual journey yourself. Tell us a little bit about that, including living with some monks in Nepal.
Yes, so that was definitely a great experience. I decided to just fly to Nepal, live in a monastery with the monks in silence. We were not allowed to talk or read a book. And it gets quite like real when you have to sit there with your thoughts. But it's very enlightening because it's part of your spiritual growth, right? And I've done lots of these kind of experiences, and that's why we're here now, because I want to share the knowledge.
And what are some of the things that you do on a daily basis to keep you grounded, to keep that positive energy that perhaps people listening today who might not be able to get a kimono, but perhaps could learn a little bit about what you've been through?
Yes, well, it's all about actually self-love. And for sometimes it's difficult, right? But you have to just continue. I go to front of the mirror and I look in my eye, literally, and say how much I love myself. Or like, you know, you can do this. It's like, even actually in corporate, before a big meeting, you know, I do this Wonder Woman pose.
I love the one. Okay, for anyone, I do Wonder Woman pose sometimes.
Right.
Because I, ironically, despite being on the radio, I really don't like public speaking. The thought of you know, you going into a boardroom and doing a pitch to people, it makes me feel nauseous. So whenever I do need to do public speaking, I'll often take myself off and just have a little moment and do hands on hips and shoulders back and chin up. Mm-hmm. And it works.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. And affirmations as well, right? As simple as that. And gratitude. I'm big on gratitude. Just create a list. And even when you don't feel grateful this morning, you will after your 15th of point.
So what's feedback been like? How are people responding?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the best part, because, you know, we literally are here to give a tool for people, for a way to heal. And we've got a lot of good reviews recently. I call them love reviews, how people's life has have transformed or changed for the better, from love life to career, for health. And it's quite incredible.
What advice would you give anyone listening today who's on that corporate ladder at the top or the bottom, but is perhaps having some of the feelings that you had a number of years ago of you know, not feeling like you're living by your values or feeling like there could be more. Because as you say, the decision to quit that job is a huge, huge leap. Mm-hmm. And if you've got family, if you've got to think about, you know, visas or salary, mm-hmm. sometimes it can feel like a dream rather than something you can actually do.
It's definitely like a courageous thing to do. Depends how miserable you are. But I did this little workshop with my partner, who literally said, like, do you see yourself, where do you see yourself in 5 years, you know? And how do you see it? And then say what you at the moment already have, right? And I was very far off what I wanted to be in 5 years. So it was more about the scare of not living my best life than comfort, you know? Mm-hmm. Because think about these days, we live a long time, right? It's not about life is short anymore. Life is long.
True. Life is long, and you could be doing a job for 50 years.
Exactly. And why? You know, it's like do what you feel like. And sometimes people don't even know. One of the things I also like to say to other entrepreneurs, start with why. Because if you don't know your why, you just don't know what you do at all. Mm-hmm. Lots of people know what they do and how they do it. But if you ask why, and you cannot say money, then it's really like, it's serious. Mm-hmm. But the moment you understand your purpose, it's going to be great.
Now, the company's not even a year old yet, but I can see from the look in your eye, you've got more planned. What are your hopes and dreams for your brand?
So, well, right at the moment, we do fashion as garments. We're also thinking of it's expanding for jewelry. We are very keen to collaborate with other brands. We are unique concept, so there isn't really energy fashion out there at all.
I'd never heard of energy fashion before I heard of you. So do you feel like this is something the industry needs to, you know, set up and take note of?
Yeah, I mean, like, that would be helpful for someone helping to go to, you know, share the knowledge. But, you know, the energy fashion is not only changing the fashion industry, but we are also extending a range of tools for healing and mindfulness. So we are always very open to collaborating, partnering up with anyone, and any competition as such is healthy. Mm-hmm. So please get in touch, by the way, if you feel like it resonates.
Well, a message from Sarah here saying, can you please say the Instagram again? Yes, it is Real Kimono Girl. That's on Instagram. So do go and check it out. Thank you so much for your time today. I think it's really fascinating to be hearing from someone who's been through this, you know, corporate and spiritual journey, but also to hear about something I literally never heard of, energy fashion. And I think it's great to think of, you know, entrepreneurs doing something differently in a city that I think I know so well, until someone comes along like you and goes, actually, there is a different way of doing it. Thank you so, so much for your
time. Thank you.
Really do appreciate it.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, we are helping you out in the world of business this afternoon. So if you've got a brand, a company, and want to start selling online, but I've got no idea where to begin, maybe Taqwa Malik can help. She's the founder of Freedom Visory, a consultancy firm that specializes in that kind of advisory role, business consultancy services on the e-commerce platform Amazon. Who else? So if you want to pick her brains, this is your chance. Taqwa with us from Freedom Advisory. So do get in touch, 4001. If you want to be anonymous, that's absolutely fine. That's the case as well for our free legal clinic that's coming up after 4. Taqwa, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much, Helen. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure. Now, I'm curious because I do a lot of online shopping. It's something I'm trying to cut back on, but the pandemic definitely kickstarted a bit of a love affair for many people when it came to e-commerce. What do you feel like if we're putting our business owner hats on today, and this could be as a manufacturer, as a distributor, what are some of the main benefits when it comes to selling products online that perhaps we as consumers might not be aware of?
For sure. Now, we need to look into the fact that shopping online is now the new norm. The 2 years of the pandemic has left us with a very strong impression that everything must go online because it won't be able to survive being offline alone. And we all lived that duration of time where it was something almost mandatory to order online because you cannot go and you cannot shop in person. The shops are not open, very limited stock available. So people adopted the mentality fairly quickly, especially in this part of the world. Shopping online is now something that happens by nature. We go and check the pricing online and check different sites and look for the better deals. So it's not going to drop anytime soon from what I'm able to see.
No.
It's only going on the rise.
And not from my bank account either. But I think that's it's such an interesting point about how quickly we adopted it. Because I remember one day my husband going, something really strange has happened today. And I was like, what's that? He's like, there wasn't a package delivered. I'm like, all right, smart Alec. But because we were buying all those essentials, but also things, you know, ways of, you know, getting fit or entertaining the kids and then, you know, clothes to wear. And we have, of course, seen a return to the malls. And I mean, my goodness, over Eid, they were absolutely jam-packed. But it's much more of the day-to-day. I buy a lot online, mainly because of time. I don't want to go around the mall with two kids in tow, and I don't get that much time on my own. So it's the convenience factor. But what are some of the challenges that companies face when selling their own products through a platform such as Amazon?
Now, the biggest challenge that everything is digital. So you need to, as a business owner, consider that your customer does not have the luxury of touching and feeling the product and just looking at it from different sides and angles and see the size and the feel. You do need to really work on the packaging, on the imaging, on the way how to position the product and find and think of the keywords. Like whenever, for example, we use Google, we just enter keywords and then Google helps with the results and for the information that we're looking for. So the owner of a business would put themselves in the shoes of their customers and think, how would they think about their product? What words would come to mind when they want to search for it? They need to consider the competition very much, because being online is a beautiful experience, but it comes with its own challenges.
Obviously, you know, not to state the obvious, but you know, tech, being tech savvy must be a big part of it, even if it's being very specific to what you are doing and what you are selling. But do you think a brand still needs to have a website, or is an Instagram account and a presence on a website such as Amazon enough?
Well, Amazon is a very strong and solidly established platform. But nevertheless, always a brand is advised to have its own presence in a medium that helps to connect its own message. Because in Amazon, it's really big. All the competition is happening. Large number of shoppers looking for different things. And it happens quite a few times. You go and try to look for an item. Then a competitor would just come in front of you right and go for that. And you would leave the original one that you came for. So recently, Amazon is trying to help brand owners with that. But in any case, the brand would always be advised to have its very own space to talk and communicate to its own customers.
And when do you advise getting in touch with an online retailer? We've had a question here from Sheila saying, I've started a small fashion company. How much stock would I need to be able to selling on a platform like Amazon? Great question, Sheila. Thank you for that.
Thank you for your question, Sheila. The good news that you do not need to start with a huge amount of stock. You can start from as small as few items, literally, just to arrange with the Amazon warehouses and inform them that I'm having this inventory coming out your way, so I would need a bit of space. You do not need to have like a pallet or a truckload. You don't need to start with that. You can start as small as you can and then grow along the way.
And a question here as well about shipping costs. Now, this is a whole other area that absolutely nothing about. Yes. But Jenny saying, I'm a brand owner looking to get into retail, but finding shipping costs prohibitive, especially on international orders. Any insights, please?
I have some good news for you that, for example, if you are a seller on Amazon UAE platform, they handle the shipping costs for you for your customers living in KSA, in Saudi, in Kuwait, Oman, and Bahrain. they just pay a small addition to the price, which is just like the customs duty, something very small. But other than that, you don't need to worry about the entire shipping cost when it comes to the GCC, because they have their own network of warehousing and logistics partners. So it's for you selling like to five countries where you are based at one. And this is what we've been seeing, for example, because it, in the main marketplace, which is the American one, when you sell in Amazon US, you immediately have the access to the Canadian population. The European market is all well connected, so the same thing is happening over here, and it's going to expand. So it is a good time to make use of such facility.
Thank you for the question, and good timing on the answer. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is, for anyone who is starting to put their products on an online platform such as Amazon, how do you make them stand out from what perhaps identical or near identical products that are going to be just there waiting to be scrolled past? Any kind of brand positioning, any, you know, words, anything that can make people stop and go, do you know what? That's the one for me. It's ticking all the boxes.
So first things first, I need to affirm the fact that you could start selling generically without a brand, and then expand as you grow and see the business is scaling up. The concept of brand is simply having few products serving the same person, resolving the same problem. Like, for example, I use three products on my skin before I go out to work in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
That's a brand. I need, for example, a cleanser, a moisturizer, and a sunblock. That's a brand because it's serving the same person, resolving the very same problem. Now, when it comes to how to make that product or that brand stand out of the competition, number one, register the trademark. Do not let it open to competitors to hijack your listing by just leaving it unprotected without registering the trademark at the competition authority, which is here the Minister of Economy. That registration step is a very solid protection, and Amazon takes brands fairly seriously, and they punish people who try to copy your listings or your imagings, because mm-hmm. you are now a real business mm-hmm. and you can have your very own space without the noise of the competitors. All of that happens when you only have the brand registered. This is number one. Number two, use all the space that Amazon gives you to make it a different and an outstanding listing. You have over 7 images that you can add in addition to a video. You have over 2,000 characters, a space that for you could write and describe your products. That's a lot. And people read. I mean, in a study I remember reading fairly recently, over 96% of shoppers, they read reviews of other shoppers before making the decision to buy.
That's what I was about to ask you, because I don't know who's writing the reviews on all the things I buy, and bless you for finding the time to do that, especially the kind of the super honest ones. I've never written, apart from maybe the odd TripAdvisor, I've never written a product review in my life. So I do think, you know, a word of recognition, but also a word of caution, because we have seen a lot of scandal about, you know, fake reviews, companies paying people to write reviews. How is that being kind of combated on the platform?
The thing that I'm really happy that I'm seeing it hopefully happening here in the Middle East, that whenever we go, let's go for the main site, which is the American, Amazon.com, you would see a small badge that says verified purchaser.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a fake review. And there is a program for early sellers to come and make use of it called Vine program, where you invite shoppers to leave a review for a future discount or for a free product. It's all legal and legit within the boundaries of Amazon. So there is a strong movement from Amazon to combat those fake reviews.
Really, really interesting. I've run out of time, but I just want to say thank you. Yes. Really interesting to think
You're
about.
The most welcome.
From, you know, from an industry insider point of view, what might be happening behind the scenes to help small businesses, you know, get the platform that they working so hard for and really deserve to be connecting with customers. For anyone that wants to find out more, perhaps we didn't get to their question on the show today, what's the best way of getting in touch with you?
I'm reachable on my email, that is freedomvisory.com, and I'll be very happy and glad to answer all the questions I receive by email, for sure. Thank you so much for the time.
Absolute pleasure.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Delighted to welcome to the show this afternoon from the lofty heights of HPL Malvern Pluka. We're talking law this afternoon with Ludmila Yumalova herself. Happy belated Mother's Day, Ludmila. How are you?
Thank you very much, and same to you. It's a happy day, as you rightfully said.
It is.
The kids are back on the normal schedule. So
I'm in such a good mood today. It's brilliant. And we've got lots of questions for you today. Before we get to the text line, Ludmila, something that caught our eyes on the news front is one for pet owners, which I am. I am the keeper of two quite noisy dogs, which is why I'm a little bit concerned about this, because residents of one Dubai neighbourhood could be facing fines of 500 dirhams if their noisy pets cause a disturbance. So a property developer has said that if the animals make, quote, excessive noise or are a nuisance, they'll be sent a notice, followed by a fine. Also reiterated that pet owners, of course, need to clean up after their pets in designated bins and make sure dogs are on a leash, and also to not feed stray cats in line with Dubai Municipality. So the notice said, while we enjoy a pet-friendly community, we'd like to remind you to follow the following pet guidelines to promote a wholesome living experience for all residents. Please note that cases of non-compliance will be issued with a notice of violation, followed by a penalty of 500 dirhams per instance. What do we know about developers putting rules and indeed fines like this in place for residents of that community?
Well, let me start perhaps with the later part of your update, and that's regarding feeding stray cats and birds and other types of animals, because that particular, news, if you will, is based on actual legal circular from the Dubai Municipality, and it has been in existence for quite some time, and it's quite clear that feeding of stray animals and birds is illegal, and there's a fine that's carried for those kinds of actions. So what we're talking about here is there's an actual legal source of authority to rely on with regards to these kinds of activities. Now, when you're talking about pets and noisy pets and developers imposing fines, that's something else, because a developer is a private party, whereas Dubai Municipality is a government authority, and obviously as a government authority, it has the authority, inherent authority, to regulate and also fine for a violation of those regulations. Whereas a developer, as long as it's a private party, their authority perhaps is a little less clear, and it can be questionable in terms of, do they actually have the authority to impose these kind of regulations, and on what basis if they do? Because every community ultimately is based on, or at least should be based on, what's called like a master community rule. So when you buy into a property, there should already be foundational rules as to what is allowed and not allowed in the community. And that becomes a legal foundation for how the property is managed. And on that basis, the developer can introduce their regulations and therefore fines. But just to make something up brand new that is not based already on the legal foundation of a particular community, that's a little questionable. But where there is authority, however, is once again Dubai Municipality. So it's less about the developer imposing these kinds of fines, but it's more about municipality. And Dubai Municipality does have the authority to also regulate various nuisances in the neighborhoods, including obviously noisy unruly pets, as well as construction noise, for example, and such. And so to that end, let me share an interesting tool that some already may know, and it's the Dubai Municipality app. And it's actually a quite an extensive app and very helpful. And it's very easy, basically, to report various events or violations or nuisances that exist in a particular neighborhood, in including pets. So you can report through the Dubai municipality instances regarding, yes, perhaps unruly pets. And it's really for the authorities then to determine what is a noisy pet or unruly pet, because it's, let's face it, it's somewhat subjective.
It's totally subjective,
it's not like meowing is not allowed, barking is not allowed. I mean, just has to be ultimately a nuisance.
My ex-neighbour, he of the, cockerel and the guard dog, he would have been a little message from the Dubai Municipality app. But Al, raising a good point, how is it that private developers can fine anyone for anything? I thought that one fundamental principle of law was that only the state can punish or impose fines. And presumably these fines are going to be going straight into the pocket of this developer. And as you rightly say, Ludmilla, it's all very subjective. And there's obviously a nice financial incentive to be imposing a few fines on residents. Here.
Yeah, and that's exactly as I said. So if, for example, at the outset of a particular community, there was a legal foundation by virtue of, in most cases, it would be a master community rules, often these master community rules would include certain regulations, such as, for example, you cannot have pets, or if you have pets, pets can only be a certain size, or you cannot do short-term let, or you can only use the pool with X number of guests per family, and so on and so forth. So these are called master community rules. So when you buy into a property, or you move into a property, then you expect it to comply with these rules. So in that case, the developer's authority is based not on their own whim, but rather on those initial regulations. And as for those regulations, how properly they would address, for example, these are the instances where these are things you cannot do in the community. And if you do those, the violations will result in a fine or a penalty. But this fine and penalty, by law and by contract, have to go back into the community, not Absolutely. Into the developer's pockets, but into the community to support the community. So it's actually community's money. So, but in that case, that would be the authority. The authority would be the master community regulations or the sales and purchase agreements, but again, contractual. But as the listener rightfully said, apart from that or absent that, there are official authorities like the municipality and or depending on where you live, so their own municipality, they may have their own regulations. And in those cases, they stem from a circular like the one I just shared regarding bird feeding and animal feeding.
Well, which raises an interesting question we're going to come to next. Mina saying, so having bird feeders in my garden is against the law. Can you put some minds at ease?
Well, the regulations actually refers to public spaces, so feeding of stray animals and birds, but in public places in particular. But the idea of this circular is to ensure that any kind of stray animals are not replicating and they're reproducing, and in fact that the authorities take care of them properly. And so the circular in particular refers to the need to call the authorities if there are stray animals in particular, to call the authorities so that they can come and make sure that these animals are taken to the proper facilities, so that, and it's all kind of in the interest of public health and safety. So so these are the important overarching statements or sentiments, if you will. One is health and safety, public health and safety, and with that in mind, that it really in particular refers to public spaces. If you're feeding birds in your own garden, that's not really quite the same as we've seen, especially in certain European countries where you've got flocks of birds in public parks and such. It's somewhat different.
Okay.
So I know the circular can perhaps be upsetting to some and many, but the idea is here again, the public health and safety, and it's with that in mind that these regulations exist, and the authority's stance is there are special dedicated authorities to deal with these kind of stray animals and birds in the way that protects public health and safety.
Thanks, Ludmilla. Speaking of public areas, question from Shane here saying, what about excessively noisy children playing in the corridors? Oh yes, common concern. Noisy neighbours. But let's open that up to noisy children in the corridors, but also perhaps neighbours moving furniture at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, where do you stand as a tenant, perhaps, or indeed an owner, when it comes to making sure you get a good night's sleep, or you're not being disturbed while trying to watch some Netflix?
Well, I'd like to think it's all about balance. And since we live in common communities or communities that are not standalone houses, it's just having neighbors and some kind of disruption and noise coming from the neighbors, it sort of goes with the territory. You cannot expect to move in into a multi-unit building and not have some kind of interference or some sort of noise from surrounding apartments. Like that's just fact of life. But it's about balance. So if you constantly have children running around in the corridor and screaming and yelling and waking up people that live in neighboring apartments, I mean, that's obviously inappropriate on many levels. So if it happens regularly, you can report this to the authority, and depending on where you live and which community you live in, Dubai Municipality would be one of those authorities. And again, it would be on the grounds of nuisance or disruption, and it's disruption to the neighbors. But it does have to kind of perhaps sway into the wrong side of, can move away from the balance and sway more into the extremes of being too loud, too regular, too consistent, and at the very odd hours. Now, from the management side of things, most communities do have regulations where they allow moving of furniture only at a certain hours, and it's with that in mind. So if you're talking about jointly owned communities, in those cases, there are almost always regulations. So there's no moving on weekends, or at least one of the days on weekends, and you can only move in during certain hours, and even then with at least certain kind of approvals. So there are regulations, and they are based on, I would like to think, some sort of common sense and common courtesy.
Exactly. I think we forget this sometimes, social contract. We're just, be a good neighbour in all senses. A question that came in earlier for you from Shireen saying, please may I ask, can Indian expats get a will made in the UAE that is valid here and in India? Can you shed some light there for anyone concerned about that?
So as long as there are non-Muslims, if it's an Indian family or a couple who are non-Muslims, they can have a will registered in the UAE. In particular, there are a number of options, but one of the more tested options is one to the DIFC Will Center. And the DIFC Will Center has, over the years, expanded its jurisdiction. And if in the past, it was only, at least when it was introduced in the beginning, it only allowed for Dubai assets to be included. Over the years, it's expanded, and now allows for global assets to be included in the will. So in this particular case, you can definitely include your Indian assets as well and anything else that you would own around the world. And that's the beauty of this particular tool, doing it for the DFC, for example. However, it's still contingent on the application of the country where you want to enforce that will. So the will definitely, when it's registered in Dubai, for example, it's more or less already has prima facie, as the legal term goes, evidence that the will is valid. But when you take it and try to enforce it in a foreign country, you need to be ready that it may be challenged if it violates that country's laws. Mm-hmm. From what I know, in India, there should not be anything that would inherently violate the laws of that country if you have a will that's properly drafted in here in Dubai. But there's always that chance. So it's if you really want to be safe, that you want to consult with a lawyer in India, not necessarily to have a separate will, but at least to confirm that however you draft the will here, that if it's possible to add additional language to increase enforceability of it in India, you can do it in the Dubai will.
Thank you for that, Ludmilla. We are talking the law this afternoon. It could be personal, it could be professional. Up next, what happens about getting paid if you haven't had a contract signed? Faulty jewellery and defective properties, all of this and more.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Ludmilla, I know there at HPL Melbourne Pluka, you cover it all, and we have had questions today following, the full gamut, really. We've got retail concerns, we've got property, we've got people worried about contracts and employment. So we are taking questions this afternoon, and let's start with this one. No name on it, saying, in December, my husband bought me a silver bracelet from a well-known jeweller's, and he gave it to me my birthday in January. It's the bead type, one of the beads has a heart charm, and at the start of April, that charm fell off. off. I contacted them to say there's no guarantee on their products except engagement rings and that I need to send the bracelet to them so they can look at repairing it. They've now contacted me to say that they can do so, but it's a cost of 500 dirhams. Am I right to be very annoyed by this? Not so much a legal question, but yes, you are.
Yes, you're certainly right to be annoyed on many counts. But with regards to the legal standing, there should be some kind of a product warranty, and especially for a piece of jewelry, and the in particular is made out of silver. Silver is not meant to break very easily. So I would say there's definitely an argument of product warranty. Now, it is common for a lot of retailers in the UAE to claim that they do not provide for this kind of warranty. And in that case, it often becomes a matter of perhaps a legal dispute. Sometimes, in fact, there is a product warranty that's sort of embedded by the manufacturer, and there's a manufacturing warranty, not so much the retailer. And it's just retailers don't really tap into it, or they don't really want to hassle themselves with tapping into that kind of warranty. So if you push hard enough, or if you insist, they will ultimately take it back and fix it on the basis of a manufacturing warranty, not so much the retailer warranty. But we are familiar with these kind of disputes. And so that's, I would say, just information is key, and education is key as well. So it's worth at least pressuring the retailer and educating them that that's something that should be covered by product warranty. On the other hand, from the legal standpoint, if everything else fails and they don't do it voluntarily, though I would argue this very bad customer service, and it would benefit the retailer to fix these kinds of issues for the long haul. The reputation will pay off whatever expense that they may incur right now in fixing the item. But if all that fails, the option is to file a complaint with the Consumer Bureau or Consumer Authority. They do often look into these kinds of issues, and depending on the...
Oh, Ludmilla's suddenly gone mute. I'm not sure if she can hear us. Ludmilla, I'm going
to... Discussions have been able to influence the retailer to reimburse or to at least fix.
If in doubt, get on Twitter. Good customer service, fantastic. Bad customer service tends to travel an awful lot faster. No name on this one, and you can always be completely anonymous if you are getting in touch with the show for some advice. Saying, looking for employment insights. I started work with a company, did 3 weeks of them before they let me go. In brackets, boss is a nasty piece of work and didn't want to hear suggestions on how they could do things better or differently, despite being that's why I was employed. No contract was signed as they were dragging their feet. Where do I stand on getting paid for the time worked? So 3 weeks done, booted out, no contract. Will this listener ever get paid, Ludmilla?
Yes, there's definitely a claim for payment of salaries. But before I discuss that further, I do just want to take the opportunity to remind listeners once again that it's not wise to start employment or any kind of contractual relationship without the proper documents in place. And I know people are very eager to get working and excited, but really it's not proper. And I don't mean to just sound like you're kind of a typical lawyer, don't do anything until you have all the documents in place. But this is one of those instances where you really shouldn't. You shouldn't do it from the contractual standpoint. You should not do it from the employment law standpoint. And you most importantly should not do it from an immigration standpoint. And that is in particular if you started work without having proper work permit and therefore visa in place. And that, by the way, often happens. What we see often is people are so eager to start work, they start work without having the work permit and therefore their visa issued. And that truly is against the law. So, but in this, that being said, we're talking about separate laws. One is a contractual law, another one is employment law, and the third one is immigration law. So immigration-wise, let's just set this aside, even if you're working illegally, that does not mean that you're deprived or that you have no legal right for the compensation or for your salary for the work that you have provided, even if you worked illegally. And that's important to keep in mind. One. Two, even if you're from a labor standpoint, or even if you don't have a signed contract, it doesn't mean that you need to have an official standard contract in order to have an enforceable relationship. A contract can be anything. It could be a standard document, or it could just be a back of a paper napkin, or it could just be verbal. It just becomes a matter of how to approve that contract. So in this particular case, 3 months, 3 weeks, even if you did not sign a contract, does not mean you did not provide services. And whenever you provide services, under the labor law, you are entitled to compensation. So now it's a matter of how to prove that you provided services. I imagine you have some kind of emails, even WhatsApp communications would suffice. You just need to be ready to present those on the one hand. On the other hand, what was the agreement about the compensation? So in other words, okay, now that you established the employment relationship, what were the terms of your payment or your salary? And once you have those two elements, you absolutely have, I mean, from the beginning, you have a legal right for it. But once you've had that evidence, now you have evidence to support your claim and specific amount of claim.
Hope that helps there, and all the very best. Not what you need in a time of insecurity, I am sure. Question here, no name on it, saying, I sold my car last week and the buyer messaged today to say she isn't happy. Car is 9 years old. Only known issue is that the boot has an issue opening, but I showed this before she took the car. She paid under the asking price, chose not to test drive it, and has just got in touch saying she's not happy. The value has been given less. A garage you got it checked out by, brake needs doing, wipers need replacing, blah, blah, blah. She hasn't asked me for anything. She just told me she's not happy. I've got no intention of giving her a refund. Am I being unreasonable or breaking the law?
Well, certainly not breaking the law. And I would say you're not being unreasonable either, given the circumstances you just described. On the legal side of things, as long as the car has been transferred, then legally speaking, now it's no longer your car, and whatever happens to the car is the responsibility of the current owner. So as long as the title has transferred hands. So legally speaking, it's no longer your problem, so to speak. On the ethical side of things, or even contractual, it sounds like you have you've given full disclosure in terms of the state of the car. It's not a brand new car, and you've shown even the various issues, and you sold it under market price. It sounds like it was not only full disclosure, but it was a fair deal. Mm-hmm. So for the buyer now to be upset, it's in a way, it's her or his fault, and it's okay. It's, you know, we buy things as they are.
I see.
You know, the term is as is. Mm-hmm. And then everything, all the risks, therefore when you buy an item as is, all the risks and liabilities then are yours to handle. So I'd say no, I wouldn't really necessarily advise to prepare any kind of legal case to fight this, because I don't think the new buyer doesn't really have a strong legal case.
Thanks, Ludmilla. Hope that helps. But yes, as you say, if she's going to get checked out by the garage, should have done that before money changed hands. Going to property now, we've got Ludmilla Maliva with us for just a few more minutes. So do get in touch if you've got any questions, concerns, you want a second opinion, or you're not even sure if your problem actually warrants an appointment. It could just be to get a bit of a plan of action. And that's really what we're asking for now, a bit of an opinion really. Laura saying, we're currently looking at buying a property in Dubai. I've heard before that the area we're looking at has had issues with, quote, build quality. Does the current owner need to disclose what maintenance he's carried out up until now? My husband is of the opinion it's luck of the draw, varies unit to unit, but any advice for a nervous first-time buyer would be great.
So does the owner, the current owner, have the obligation? There isn't a specific law that requires for the owner to provide full disclosure and full obligation. However, the prospective buyer should absolutely and has the right to request all the information. And if the information is not available, then at least hire their own contractor and survey the property with a professional contractor to document whatever issues there might have existed. And also, if the current owner is assuring you that all the management or maintenance issues have been resolved or they are insignificant, then definitely include that in the contract itself, so that in the event you find out some skeletons in the closet later down the road, you at least have a contractual term you might be able to pursue for misrepresentation. So there are ways to protect yourself, and I will tell you, it's actually quite surprising still to this day, it's quite uncommon in the UAE for buyers to bring their own inspectors and do their own property surveys. And I would say it's a wise thing to do because it will give them the, information is power, but it will give them the additional information they need and assurances and comforts. And therefore, if they do choose to, it's not to say that if they do discover certain issues, not to say that they don't necessarily want to proceed with the purchase, but at least they will have full disclosure and they can prepare for the ownership on that basis. So I'd say definitely negotiate with the buyer, ask them for all the disclosures, but be prepared. They may not necessarily be open, and in that case, have your own contractors in place and certainly insist on having access to the property and inspect the property ahead of time. Because I tell you, the number of times we've had issues, I'll give you an example, is when somebody buys a property and then they find out that because the property is based, let's say, over a garage, it's extremely loud, mm-hmm. or it's next to a garbage chute. There's a foul smell that comes from it all the time. Well, but contractually and legally, there's very little that we can do because none of this was ever disclosed or discussed in the negotiations or in the contract. So this is just an example for parties who are considering buying. Whatever issues are important to you, include them in the contract.
Thank you, Ludmilla. Laura, all the very best with the property hunt. Staying with property, Lydia's been in touch saying our landlord is saying it's not legal to do a 6-month rental contract. Is that true?
It's not illegal. It's just it's harder to register it with the JARI because the JARI usually it requires a 1-year contract. But it's not against the law. You can do short-term contracts. Is that sometimes certain properties, for depending on the length of the contract, and they may require special licenses if you want to really do short-term. But it's not illegal. It's just more that for now we don't really have a mechanism mm-hmm. to register, for example, a 3-month contract or a 6-month contract as the way we have registering a 1-year contract with the JARI. But otherwise, it certainly is not illegal.
And last question, I'm going to squeeze in this one. No name, saying we want to employ a nanny directly, not through an agency. Is there a standard contract template? Are benefits such as holiday entitlement, airfare reimbursement, gratuity, etc., all standard, or is it the discretion of the employer? Any help or advice would be greatly appreciated.
Is both of them. There's definitely standard terms, the minimum terms, and there is a standard contract that whenever you apply through immigration, because for nannies, you would be applying through immigration, and there is a standard contract that they use, and all of these relevant terms are already described in that contract, and for the most part, they are based on the law that covers domestic employees. But certainly, as an employer, you're always free to include additional benefits. You cannot take away from the minimum benefits, but you certainly can modify and include anything additional that you want to brand to your employees.
Ludmilla, thank you so much for your time, your insights as ever. We have had it all on the show today. Really do appreciate it. And we didn't get to your question today. Don't forget Ludmilla Maliver joining us every Monday afternoon for your free legal clinic. Ludmilla, wishing you a wonderful week ahead. Thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.